Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
So the truth of the Tathagata's words, what is the Tathagata and what are words? we're talking about some of these words today, but we usually begin by just going around and giving our names, and our names are words also. So I would like you and me when you're to listen to everyone's name and just pay attention to what your mind is doing with each name. Maybe it's a familiar name, or it's just like somebody else I know, or I don't pronounce the name that way, or I don't really understand that name. I'm frustrated. You know, all kinds of things you can do. That name is colorful, and so on. So just observe your own mind. You can forget the name in a sense, but observe what your mind is doing when you hear it. So my name is Jiro.
Judy.
Felix.
Good, thank you. Well, that was a quick inventory of your busy mind, probably. What I would like to do now is for you to relax and listen to a few words, and just pay attention to what your mind and body do in relation to these few words. This room. All right, now that wasn't exactly a poem, but each of you could, I think, experience some meaning or sense in each of those words. And in most cases, you were perhaps, when I said seat, you were aware of this seat and window, perhaps these windows, and trees outside, and then stillness and sky. Perhaps you can't really see it, you're maybe imagining the sky. So you heard all of these verbally. Now in a sense, what you heard was the sound of these letters, right? Now, when we look at this word here, there's no sense of looking at a room. All we are doing is seeing the sounds, and our mind somehow puts these sounds together and comes up with the sounds of the sound making the sounds which make for a room, and then we know the word room as its sound, and then the meaning comes to us after hearing the sound, or after our mind gives us the sound. So this is rather different from the Chinese character. The Chinese character is a picture of some kind of experience in general, or it refers to some kind of experience or some kind of object, at least initially. And of course, this is This is a gross generalization because it's not true of all Chinese characters by any means, but at basis and when they were first formed, every character was referring to an object or a motion or an experience of some sort. So when a person looks at this, they are more directly experiencing its meaning without any diversion, so to speak, to the sound. So it's quite fundamentally, the brain is doing something different. And apparently this kind of, when we go through this sound aspect, and then we can project the meaning of room into these letters. The mind, it's more a left brain activity, and this more direct experiencing of the meaning is a little more right brain or both brain activity. When China developed the Chinese characters, one reason they were successful or necessary is because, of course, China was a mix of many little kingdoms and districts, and they all had their own dialect or their own language, and China as a whole, nobody could communicate with everyone with any language. But by speaking, by writing characters in every language, this character could be pronounced because the meaning itself was presented. So no matter what your language's pronunciation of this, it didn't matter. It was just that the meaning came through right away. So that's the reason the first the unifying emperor of China was able to control the whole country, because the important people, the leaders of all of the districts and kingdoms and so on, they could all read and they could communicate with each other that way. So here we have a seat, and this character is rather interesting. Here we have two persons, and this part means ground. So we have persons sitting together on the ground. So as soon as you see that, your body is, in a sense, sitting on the ground, you could say. It's more direct than trying to figure out seat or seat or, you know, what are these sounds? Here we have a roof and a these two lines suggest removal or separation or digging out, and then this is supposedly a window with some kind of lattice on it. And here, it's quite interesting, though, when you look at the word trees, for instance, you can sort of, do you sort of picture trees in it somehow? Can you? The T has a kind of tree-ish effect, and the E's can be branches or something. And here are the Chinese trees. So they're a little more obviously trees. Shaolin, here are the two trees. This means a few, and this means trees. So Shaolin Temple is place of a few trees. And then stillness. The word still has to my mind, it has a little sense of all of these verticals get sort of stopped feeling. And here in the Chinese character, this is life, or in fact, it also refers to plants. And this part is color or red. And for some amusing reason, this character can mean green or blue. So this red probably is just simply suggesting color, the presence of color. And this side is very interesting because it's supposedly a hand at the top and a hand here, and these two hands are in conflict. And why this character has come to mean stillness is kind of a wonder. So it's this is a good example that Chinese characters are not their etymology can be very complicated, and sometimes it's not very reasonable to the modern mind anyway. Then we have sky. There are two Chinese characters which can be used for sky. This is more like heaven, or the what is above, or greater than we are. And this one is more like the, perhaps a little more just the sky itself. This again is the a dome or a roof which is empty, and this adds a sense of labor to increase the emptiness. So you can see that these two ways of writing are really quite amusingly different. And as you were hearing these words, the whole experience could happen if you were describing the experience of hearing room, seat, window, trees, stillness, sky. You could recall it with all of these elements, and you wouldn't necessarily have to say I in your description, would you? Or would you? If you were telling someone else about your sitting here and experiencing in your mind and body room, seat, window, trees, stillness, sky, you probably would eventually say I, right? I was sitting here and in this room, and I looked through the window, and I saw the trees or something. So when you sort of elaborate on it or want to talk to somebody else, you naturally add I. But the experience itself could happen without I, right? Somehow. I mean, when you think about it, you put your I in, of course, but the experience itself, was there an I there? It's kind of a curious question. Sort of along that line, here are some sort of succinct phrases. On this simple pathway, where nothing or everything is special, suddenly, innocently, a tiny, simple pink rose looks up from its few leaves and slender, thorny stem. A pause, as if to ask permission to inhale its air. The aroma, modest, profound, deeply probing, fulfilling. Nothing else like it in this amazing earth. So this is a way of writing and without necessarily putting I there. Don't you think that if you put I in here, it would the openness of this experience would somehow kind of get narrow? I think maybe it may be for a good reason that this is virtually an ideograph. this is the I, and see how narrow it is. when you say I, you're cutting out an awful lot. All of this, which is around us, as we were experiencing just the seat or the window or the trees, it's sort of out in order to affirm this I, this very narrow creature. This I hadn't realized before, but this really is an ideograph. This is a picture of I. It's sort of scary in a way. Well, this kind of thinking is perhaps stimulated or evoked by staring at the wall, sitting in meditation here and staring at the wall. And who is the most famous person for staring at the wall? But this man sitting up here. You also walk by a picture of him in the hallway there. This is Bodhidharma. This is an unusual picture of him to us nowadays, because the pictures we always see of Bodhidharma are, he's much more rugged looking, and if not wild, and very hairy, and sort of menacing or angry, or anyway, kind of very unusual looking. But this rubbing is from the Sung Dynasty, which is like 12th, 13th century China. So it may be before the image of Bodhidharma became fixed. And Bodhidharma is considered to be the person who brought Zen practice of sitting in meditation, staring at the wall. He brought that from India. Oh, good, thank you. he brought this supposedly from India, although there's one of the earliest records regarding him says that he came from Persia. Basically, he's a mythological character. He's like the bodhisattvas or something, almost. I mean, he serves a purpose because he his story sort of expresses many of the basic focuses of Zen practice. But his historicity is completely unclear and not well known. So this scroll or this paper was originally written, at least this these letters were written on paper, and then it was the paper was glued onto a flat stone, and then all of the letters were carved. So these letters were carved into the stone, and then papers like this were put onto the carved stone, and then ink was dabbed on, and everywhere where the paper went into the cracks remained white, and the part that is on the flat surface was inked. So this is a reverse black and white of the original. And it was written by Huang Dingchen, who is a rather well-known calligrapher and poet of late Northern Song Dynasty China. He lived from around 1145 to 1205. And he was a friend of Su Dong Po, who was the most famous sort of scholar, as well as a bureaucrat, but he was famous as a scholar of Song China. And Su Dong Po and Huang Dingchen, this calligrapher, they were members of a conservative political party, and at this time in China, the political system was such that there were sort of two parties, and the important point was to get the emperor to support you. So for a while, the emperor was supporting the conservatives, and then that emperor died, and then the next one perhaps supported, in the case of Su Dong Po and Huang Dingchen, the progressives were in power with the emperor, and then that emperor died young, and the next emperor was only 10 years old, so his grandmother was the regent. Grandmother liked the conservatives. So for about 10 years, then Su Dong Po and that party, including Huang Dingchen, they were in power, and they enjoyed life in the capital, and their ideas were furthered. But then when the young emperor matured and then became recognized as the emperor, he favored the progressives. So the progressives threw out all of the conservatives, and they were sent into exile. And getting sent into exile was not just going to another country. It was called hell. If you were sent into exile south of the Yangtze River, that was like being sent to hell, because there were weird people living there, and there were lots of malaria. So it was more or less a death sentence sooner or later. So both Su Dong Po and Huang Dingchen died in exile. Huang Dingchen himself was very interested in Buddhist practice. He seems to have been a Zen Buddhist to some extent, and so he perhaps visited a Shaolin temple and was asked to write this. I assume this is at Shaolin Temple, but I'm not sure where this stele, this stone would be called a stele. I'm not sure where it is located now. But this says, this is ancestor, and this is a source, and this is truth. This is an interesting word. This side is words, and this is emperor. So it means, you know, very important words, or obviously it has to be truth if the emperor says it. And then this means foundation, also root. And then this says Shaolin 9 years, because Bodhidharma is famous for having sat 9 years at Shaolin Temple. This is to hang down or to hand down. And this supposedly now, in the time of the Sung Dynasty, these two words meant pithy, sharp or succinct, pithy words or teaching. This is true. And this is arrive. And this is thus or thusness. So this his pithy words arrived thus, meaning perhaps from the 9 years of sitting in the at the temple, or it can mean the with this these pithy words were straight or correct or true, and as a result, thusness arrived. So you can, this is what happens when apparently when Chinese people read Chinese, they can, you know, there are different interpretations you can come up with. So this could mean just thus, but this could also mean thusness, meaning the most important right here, this present momentness. And of course, I love to point out that this character itself is formed of woman and mouth. So this the thusness or this ultimate reality is what comes from the mouth of woman. Isn't that wonderful? In this very masculine whole religion with all these monks running around, the most important thing comes from the mouth of the woman. So somehow there's a slight sense of balance. So we have that. And then I'll show you the early forms. This was the early, this is called seal script, the earliest form. And then this form gradually evolved to this when the brush is being used. You can see the brush has many modulations. In when seal script was written, they didn't really have a brush. It was maybe scratched in sand or using a stick or charcoal or something. So this triangle has a sense of unity or oneness, and this is supposed to indicate reaching out or connecting. And so now it means now. And then this one comes from this early form. This again is mouth. And then this is the sounds coming from the mouth. So this came to mean words. And this part is branches, two branches brought together. And at the place of oneself, this is like the nose, oneself. And in some miraculous way, these two ideas merged, the idea of phrases being brought together like branches and creating and all coming together. So this means everything or all. It's pretty complicated etymology there. So this is, these are the words, and this is the very differently formed branches. And then this one, directions. Now this is an early form of that. And sometimes even the swastika is the same, basically the same idea of the energy sort of whirling around in all directions. So we have now in all directions, and then we have this interesting character. Its early form, this is a seashell with its tentacles or legs coming out. And then this is two sheaves of grain, which are held by this hand. So this hand is doubling the seashell. The seashell is money or value. So this is increasing the value. So this means gain or profit or benefit. And then this last one is quite interesting as well. At the top, I'm missing one part here, but at the top are is a spoon which has a bit of food in it, so it means it's a full spoon being offered, and these are the hands which are offering it, and then these hands are receiving it, and then this is another hand which was added to give the idea of offering the whole thing up or raising it up. So this character can mean to raise or to offer or to honor. So that's this character. So we have now in all directions, benefit or profit is raised up, or the prophet is honored, or the whole process is being honored. So our calligraphy group, yesterday and the day before, we worked on these characters, and you can see how people did them up over there on that window. It's quite kind of scary to have people coming just for one day or 2 days, and they end up writing five characters that are actually legible. You wouldn't say they are marvelously written, but they are, you know, completely legible. You know, if you're a proper calligraphy student, you start by writing number one for many days or weeks, just number one. And you know, there are many aspects to just writing one stroke. So for these people to write this is kind of, it's both good and bad. But they did a good job as far as being really focused on it, actually. So it's very nice to see that. All right. I think, I wanted to just read for you. I mentioned that Sutong Po and Huang Ting Chen were exiled. This is the poem that Sutong Po, and supposedly because of this poem, he was exiled. He was sent to hell because of this poem. An old man of 70 sickle at his waist, feels guilty. The spring mountain bamboo and bracken are sweet. It's not that the music of Shao has made him lose his sense of taste. It's just that he's eaten his food for 3 months without salt. Okay, can you imagine? This is a disastrous political statement. So maybe in our time, as our politics gets more and more sensitive, we can understand why even an innocent seeming poem like this could send someone to hell. by saying that, by complaining that he didn't have any salt, that was a terrible attack on the minister of salt, and the minister was, you know, very loyal to the emperor, a friend, sort of a friend of the emperor. So this was an attack on the state. So obviously the consequence is that you have to be sent to hell. So the importance of words, you know, it's just wondrous and amazing how words can both create heaven and they can create hell. Now, Huang Tingchen himself was quite famous for his poetry, and in particular because he established what was considered a school of poetry for the first time in China. It was a real school of poetry was developed under him, or through his, in part because of his activity. And what he was furthering was the appreciation of the whole tradition from the very earliest time, when they were just these folk songs from the most ancient times of China. And then all kinds of poetic expressions had been preserved. And then Huang Tingchen felt that it's very important for anyone who's a serious poet to be familiar with all these traditional poets, and then to express their spirit or their qualities and so on in your own poetry. So you shouldn't just go off and just do your own poems without any appreciation or reference to the ancients. Well, in this time, you know, everything was done by, had been done by writing and copying on scrolls. So who's going to be able to even see any number of ancient writings? Well, it just so happens conveniently that in the Song Dynasty, in 970, or by 970, the printing press in China had become really a functioning practice, and the emperor began to support the publication, the printing of all of the classic writings. So in the Song Dynasty, this was the first time that anyone who was seriously interested could actually get and read copies of the ancient writings. So this was this is what would enable him to say, well, everyone should be familiar with the whole tradition. You couldn't have said that earlier because it just wasn't possible. So this idea of expressing in your own poetry the thoughts and words of the ancients was sort of a view that was in, on one hand, very deeply appreciated, and then also gradually became frustrating to many people, because if I'm always reiterating all the ancients, how am I ever going to express my own real self or my nature or something? And this is, of course, what happened with painting as well. In the painting tradition, there developed this idea that the only really good painting is the painting which is done in the manner of so-and-so from, you know, 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. That's real painting. And so if I'm going to paint well, I need to paint like those people. But then, of course, there was a reaction to that eventually as well. So Huang Tingchen is kind of it's strange, because when it comes to calligraphy, his calligraphy is not like the calligraphy that was had been sort of furthered and highly regarded all through the Tang Dynasty and into the Song Dynasty. That was the calligraphy of Wang Shizhi, who was the great calligraphy sage, and whose writing was really quite elegant. Every stroke, you know, had a certain beauty, and of course the whole work was just people were just in awe of his ability to write so beautifully, and so everybody was trying to write beautifully. Well, of course, not everyone can write beautifully, and you get tired of just simple beauty. So there had been Yan Jianqing was famous at the end of the Tang Dynasty. He was very sort of forceful and more masculine and more sort of he also was very sure of himself, and so he expressed this in his calligraphy. And then when you get to Huang Tingchen, his style is very uniquely his. So he's very much expressing himself in his calligraphy. He's not writing like somebody else. And he even uses the idea that calligraphy should be a little awkward or a little bit imperfect. And of course his has that kind of imperfection in that he likes to have very long horizontals, for instance, and he also likes this kind of stroke to make him extended. And so some of his calligraphy does feel kind of awkward, but there's some vitality in it, which you don't necessarily have if you're trying to make it so all just beautiful. Your whole life force kind of gets, if you're just concerned with beauty or elegance. So of course, being a great character, he sort of had in his own life, wanting to appreciate the ancients and value their poetry and so on, but he also was irrepressible in expressing himself, at least in his calligraphy. So we've now sort of finished our exploration of this scroll, so it'll be hanging around here for a while. So I hope people can just appreciate looking at it and thinking about Bodhidharma, and just maybe on your own exploring stories about Bodhidharma and his relation to the whole Zen tradition, because he's one of the ancients. And so how much are we going to receive from him as an ancient and try to imitate or work with in our own pathway. Yeah, that's it's hard to know, because in Chinese as well, you can say room, you can hear the sound, and then you have the meaning, and then in English, same thing. So in both languages, that's happening. But I don't know whether, whether the sound to meaning, and then sight to meaning, are they the same kind of jump, or is it different? I wonder. Yes.
I guess I can't, having a little bit of linguistics training, I can't resist, I guess, offering just a little bit of what supposedly we're taught about this, is that the speech-based language, and writing from sounds, is considerably older than writing systems, which mm-hmm. are based on these images. But as you say, there's these two channels of different kinds of meaning that come together in these different things. But supposedly speech-based, which themselves also supposedly in the earlier times were onomatopoeic, where the sounds were the sounds of a thing, that maybe the sound of a bird chirping would mean bird and this sort of thing. So there's these different tracks, but one's based on sound and speech, and the other is based on vision and creating images. And the sound presumably is older. But the thing I was thinking about was your question about the, you offered these words, right, room. And since it didn't say, you know, we supposed to make it tell a story, if we were going to connect them, and we start putting ourselves in. But I thought maybe since it was interesting, the only dynamic one that I really heard was stillness, why would I suppose anybody's involved at all? I mean, maybe I'm really picturing the Zendo, nobody's here. And that's when it's really still, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe we're here. Or is it the same, whether we're present or not? Is it just as still? Maybe not.
Good. That'll keep you busy. Anyone in Zoom land have a comment? The lunch bell has rung, so now's your chance.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.